Yes, and so that's the very beginning,
right,
of that this book is about perspective, and that their perspective, especially Jane's perspective, is going to be a little different.
What a beautiful day.
It is a pretty day.
I want to be out.
Finally, right?
Everything looks cleaner and brighter when the sun's out, just like Jane says.
If you're upside down.
If you're upside down.
And backwards.
Well, when I first started reading The Moffats, the first time I read it, I kind of shrugged it off. It was one of those where it was just little episodes, episodic in nature, and I didn't quite understand the value that I know that you guys placed upon it, because I'd heard you talking about The Moffats, and I knew that we were really investigating it deeply. So then I read it again, and then I actually read it again, and the more I read it, the more I realized there's a lot of good stuff in this. And some of it just comes down to the quality of the writing. So often, I think in these early grades, when we're reading these books, they're well written to an extent, but obviously they're written to an age group where you can't be very lyrical all the time. You know, you may introduce a simile or a metaphor once, you know, and allow students to catch on, but I mean, this story just begins with a great, the way Mama could peel apples. I mean, you haven't had an introduction like that, I think, yet, where it's just this kind of sudden drawing into the story. And so I began to enjoy the quality of the writing. And then as I was reading through some of our essential questions and thinking about them as I read the book, that's how I began to realize that this book requires contemplation. It's not just a book that we read for fun. It's a book that we read for contemplation. And that elevated the quality of the book in my eyes. And it made it a book that I actually enjoyed coming back to that second, that third time.
First, you said that this book is deeper than it appears. And I think that this is a great book to use in terms of considering how Memoria Press approaches a book, as opposed to the way, you know, you might approach a book without a contemplative attitude.
Yes.
And so this book has so much to offer if you treat it, if you engage with it, and if you're looking for the valuable nuggets in this book. So to read this book closely is a very valuable experience. And so if you read this book for comprehension or just on a surface level for entertainment purposes, it's wonderful in that way. It is an enjoyable, entertaining
there's
book.
There's great scenes.
If you try to contemplate this book, there's plenty there to contemplate. And so, you know, I mean, I've said this a million times, to complete a book is not to comprehend a book. To comprehend a book is not to contemplate a book. And this is a great book at the beginning of the curriculum to see the distinction between those two approaches to literature. And so I like that you said that and pointed that out, because I think, you know, this could really alert the reader to that.
Well, and I think that something that we ought to discuss is that to contemplate a book, yes, you need to read it more than once.
Right.
That's true. The first reading is
right.
Never enough.
Right.
And sometimes you can, and especially as you become a better reader, you can get quite a lot in that first reading, but it's the second, the third reading
right.
where you do see, oh, that scene,
right.
which was so silly,
right.
is some allusion to something else that's some deeper
and it's beautiful.
It's like teachers, the first year they teach something, it's not near as good as the third or the fourth year, because it keeps getting better and better and better.
And richer and richer. And a good book, you know, is that book that has levels and meaning and, you know, more to offer with every single reading. And, you know, the other thing you said in your introduction, you know, the way Mama peeled apples, you know, a good writer with beautiful imagery, with, you know, real things to say, and you might think, well, that's, you know, what's so important about peeling apples, but it struck you and it spoke to my children too. I was saying beforehand, you know, a few years after one of my daughters read this book, we were in the kitchen together and I was making something with apples, and she just, you know, said, the way Mama peels apples, that sentence lived in her heart.
That's right.
You know, for years after reading this book. So there's something to that. There's something, you know, magical about that writing and that, you know, really attached to my daughter, it attached to you, the exact same sentence. And so, you know, I think that's something to point out too, that great books are beautiful in a way that maybe we can't even explain.
That's right. Something about good writing gets into the skin of our students and lives with them in a way that's beautiful. And that's the kind of thing we ought to be encouraging
right.
with them,
that's
is
right.
find the thing that really touches you in a way. And some of these essential questions we've talked about before, and that's the point. This book is carrying on some of the very same questions that we have talked about in Charlotte's Web and Little House in the Big Woods, Farmer Boy, and some of the others that we've done. And so let's get started with some of these. I think one of the better questions to ask at the beginning here is, how is home defined? How do you know when you're there? Where do we see that particular theme throughout this book?
Home, community, family.
That's right.
It's huge in this book.
Yeah.
But the context of it is 1941 is when it was published. So it is a small community in a safe neighborhood. And we see at the beginning that Jane is afraid of Chief Mulligan. He's, mm-hmm. you know, the big policeman around town. But by the end of that first chapter, they're good friends.
That's right.
And it's a community that looks after each other. And home is a safe place to be. And it's the ironic thing about it is the whole premise of the book is that their home is for sale.
That sign is up right. the whole time.
Right. Yeah. And they're in fear of losing right. their home because they're it's a single mother with three children.
Four
children. I forget Sylvie all the time. Four children, and she's a seamstress trying to make a living to support her family, and the landlord decides to sell the house that they're renting. Because times are hard. And so it's going to affect them. And so, but home still is such a nice place for them to all, they always come back to it. They go That's out right. in the community and they always come back to it. And they don't judge each other. You know, when, what's his name, loses the...
Joe.
When the Joe last. Loses the money and... And it's, I mean, it's like their last dollar that he loses.
$5
to get coal.
Yeah.
And he loses it. And when he comes back home, they all just pitch in to help him find it. And Mama says, well, it's gone. If it's gone, it's gone. I'll just work overtime to make up for it. There is no judgment. She doesn't blame him. You know, it could happen to anybody. And I think she really trusts her children. Mm-hmm. In a way that I didn't trust much. I mean, she really does place, because I think she's a single parent in hard times, coming out of the Depression, and their father has died. Mm-hmm. So she's been through that when Rufus was a baby. So she's raised these four kids by herself for a while now, for several years. And I think she has to trust them because they have to be more mature. They have to do things that you wouldn't normally expect children of their age to do.
Well, and there's such a gratitude for, you know, we started talking about home, and I think, you know, in this book, there's such a love of that yellow house.
The yellow house.
And at the beginning, and perspective plays a huge role in this book. And so, you know, the yellow house, which is the best house on the street because it's the only house where you can see both ends of mm-hmm. the street. And so, you know, which places the house, you know, in a central place on the street, but also in the children's heart. And so I think there is sort of a relationship between the people in the home and the home itself. And so the home is representative of this love and, you know, just the children's gratitude and just sunny disposition toward their place and their people, you know, and, I think it's so easy to just look for debits in your, you know, in your living environment, you know, but the Moffats look for credits always.
They
they're always looking for credits and they're always looking for the positive things, and they're not tallying up, you know, the mistakes or the annoyances mm-hmm. or the difficulties, you know, but they're always, you know, just keeping track of all the positive things. And they're just building a community of gratitude within their home, within their neighborhood, within Cranberry at large. And so perspective is just enormous in mm-hmm. terms of just the joy with which this family operates.
Yeah.
I think it's all really summed up at the end when they're getting ready to move. And Jane in her head goes through all of the different things that happened in the home as she looks at it. And, you know, she's sad to be leaving her home. And she says, they couldn't help feeling stunned. Rufus didn't remember living in any other house. He had learned to talk, learned to walk, and had 5 birthdays and 5 Christmases in this house. Jane had made paper dolls, studied through the 13 colonies in school, knew every inch of this house except the little used dirt cellar, and had flown down the stairs hundreds of times, even if it was just in her dreams. And Joe and Sylvie, though they remembered the old house across the way and remembered Papa too, they had always felt this yellow house would be theirs forever.
There's this beautiful line. I was hoping you weren't going to say it because it was something I wanted to bring up. But there's this beautiful line where as she's going to the new house, she realizes that yellow house will live on in her memory like a glowing ember. And that repeats a story that had the Joe story where he had lost the money for coal and a piece of coal had fallen out. But that's such a beautiful image that, yes, that particular place will live on in a way that's still kind of burning in her memory, and not burning in the sense of sorrow, but burning in the sense of warmth and home. That was a place, because I think one of the key discussions of home in this book is that it is a place, not just people. And we sometimes like to be cute and talk about how, well, wherever you are, that's home for
me. Right, wherever your family is.
And yes, that's true. And there's a beautiful idea there. But there's also the reality that a particular place matters.
Right.
You know, and
a place where you feel you belong.
A place that's almost a holy ground kind of place, that this is sanctified to us. This is
your safe
something
spot.
That's devoted to us, you know, and I think that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And when it does change, when that place changes, it can still be a memory. It can still live there and be a powerful, not just a dormant memory, but a burning. There's some energy to it there. It's still there in your memory, even when you go to a new place.
And, you know, I think, and again, you know, the symbolism of the yellow house, the burning embers, mm-hmm. you know, but also perspective. I mean, at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, Jane is looking upside down and backwards.
That's right.
You know, and so
her
I think that
down, well,
yeah, I mean,
looking.
I think that gives us clear instructions at the beginning to pay attention to the perspective of this book. And so the, you know, what you just said, this house is not grand. It's not, you know, they're in difficult times, but the way that they look at it is just so adorable and wonderful. I mean, they live next to a brick lot and they
which
think
thrills
you know,
them.
Oh, yes. They think it's the yes. greatest boon. And, you know, and so, I mean, just the way that they're approaching their life and the gratitude and the way they see the thing.
Very optimistic.
Yes. And it's just so sunny. And so it's, I mean, it's perfect that the house is, you know, a bright yellow house in
that's
the
right.
middle of the street where you can mm-hmm. see everything.
Well, that's related to another question that we've already talked about in several other books, but what does it mean to be part of a family or community? So this house is centrally located on this mm-hmm. street that allows them to see both ways, and it's connected to neighbors that they grow fond of. So let's explore that. What does it mean to be part of a family or community?
It means they're safe.
That's right.
It means, you know, that they can get in a wagon with the Salvation Army man.
Yes.
And lose
who is a
him.
Stranger, but you're, still
right.
recognized.
But because he was the Salvation Army
that's right.
man, he felt safe.
That's right.
To them. And the policeman is safe. Yeah. And all of the neighbors, the man that runs or whoever runs the candy store, all of those people know them and know their community. And, you know, we lived in a very small rural community. I don't know that this one's not really rural, but there was one town square, one grocery store, one drug store, and everybody knew my children. They knew who they were because it was small. And so it was safe because if I wasn't there, there were people there who knew who they were and would take care of them. And I feel like that's the world that has been created here. And I think that's a world that we've lost, mm-hmm. sadly, but that is so valuable that we would have a community of people that we belong to and that who belong to us. Wendell Berry says, he calls it a membership.
That's right.
You know, your members
yeah.
together, your members one to the other. And I think that is beautifully created here.
The neighborhood is not, I mean, we've romanticized this neighborhood, but it is an authentic neighborhood too. I mean, there are so many interesting characters and eccentric mm-hmm. characters and, you know, the Miss Chester, the dance instructor,
yes.
and Captain Mulligan, the police officer. And, you know, Peter Frost and, you know, there are
who's
some...
the bully.
Like, that's right.
Bully.
Yes. Yeah.
They do get the best of him,
that's right.
but
yeah.
it's at their own expense.
That's right. The Murdoch family who's investigating or inspecting the house and considering buying it. And, you know, there are some...
Annoyances.
And just, yeah. you know, genuine real things about the neighborhood. It's not so wonderful to the children because it's perfect. It's so wonderful because of their attitude
yes.
about these things.
But I mean, Joe having to dance
yes.
because, I mean, just the fact that these children are taking dance class, that was considered important to Mama, and Joe having to do it. You know, Miss Chichester was so, she was like the bane of his life. I think
That's
he
right.
says that.
That's right.
But
the
then he
recital.
Ends up dancing and is the star of the show.
Well, not he wasn't the star. The dog.
Well, the dog was,
yes,
but he
right.
felt like
right, right.
he suddenly was enjoying it. And when she forgot to pay him his dime,
he went on whistling.
He because was still happy.
It was
whistling
one of the best days.
In the rain.
Right, right.
Whistling in
yeah.
the rain.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
So it is a real community in the
it
sense
is.
That
it, the children
there's
are
still
always
danger.
Happy
there's
with
still,
their
right.
Yeah.
But the, right. but the way, you know, the what makes this book so funny, I think, is the disconnect between the narrative perspective. So it's written with such an adult wisdom through the eyes of Jane. And so that gap in perspective is really the thing that makes mm-hmm. it so funny. If, you know, for instance, you know, Jane thinking Captain Mulligan is, you know, terrifying. She thinks, you know, Peter Frost has told her she's going to
yes.
be arrested
yes.
because she imitated him on the sidewalk. And so she's terrified of Captain Mulligan, who is charming and turns out to
That's
be a dear
right.
friend to her.
Yeah.
And she's hiding from him. And he says, well, and he comes to protect her. Who are you hiding from? What's, you know, how are you in danger? And she says, well, I'm hiding from you. And he just, you know, laughs. I mean, he just has this great, huge laugh. And, you know, it's just such a warm, friendly, protective sort of experience. And, you know, just that gap in perspective makes the book funny, but also it makes it real because, you know, from a child's perspective, of course you might be afraid of, you don't know all, you know, maybe that is a law that you don't know about.
That's right.
That's you right. know, the children's innocence,
right.
yeah. you know, contributes to a lot of worry. And so, so in that way, imagination plays two roles in this book. I mean, it's hugely important to the children, and you can see in so many of the episodes, imagination really serving the children well. So, you know, they're waiting, and there's just a neighborhood horse, and they imagine that it's a bridge, it's, you know, a Pegasus, it's, you know, the Trojan horse, it's, you know, all of these things that are imaginative and make the experience fun, you know. The same situation with Jane in a bread box. You know, she's mm-hmm. got all, she's a princess. She's, you know, all of these things that are entertaining her. But then in the same way, imagination, you know, turns into fear when she is also imagining Captain Mulligan being a threat to her
that's
or
right.
being, you know, trouble for her. And so, you know, I think that that's an interesting thing to point out to the children is that, you know, imagination can serve us and punish us.
Yes.
Yes. And then he had wings and could carry her away. He was the wooden horse of Troy, and many men could step out of him. He was a bridge that she could walk under. Sitting up there on the hitching post, watching the horse and watching the horse, Jane repeated to herself, "The horse is a bridge for me to walk under, and I'm going to walk under." So
well,
she does.
And that's another great thing about this book. It has... I mean, it is rich with allusions. So, you know, even in just this conversation, we've talked about the horse Troy and the Pegasus, but you know, all of the music is, you know, actual music that students can listen to. There's
like the sailor's hornpipe.
That's right. There are tons of references to poetry, to song, to stories. I mean, Cinderella, Little Bo Peep,
Little Match Girl.
She
yeah,
talks
that's
about
right.
Little
Match
Girl.
Robert Louis Stevenson poems. I mean, the things mm-hmm. that the children are doing in this book, it's rich with sort of cultural literacy that the students can attach to and explore. So, you know, those are things that a parent reader or a teacher wouldn't want to miss.
Well, we've been talking about this now for a bit, but this is actually one of our newer essential questions for this novel. And so I'd like to go ahead and just simply ask it and really explore some of these things about perspective that we've been talking about more deeply. So How does perspective contribute to contentment or dissatisfaction? We've already talked about this some, but let's explore that more deeply.
I think the original beginning, which is even on the cover of the book, is Jane upside down looking at the house.
That's right. Because what does that mean?
Great house, but to her it is. And she says when she's upside down, looking at it upside down and backwards, that it looks clearer and brighter, cleaner. Yes.
Cleaner and brighter, right?
Yes.
And the sun shining on it.
Yes. And so that's the very beginning of that this book is about perspective, and that their perspective, especially Jane's perspective, is going to be a little different.
Well, and that's exactly, you've already mentioned this, but it bookends this book, because at the end, when they go to the new house, she does the same thing.
Right.
And she sees what seems to be an even more disappointing house in a new light.
Yes.
Right.
And the yard isn't so great, but...
But she finds a friend in the yard.
She does. And so we can anticipate. I mean, it ends in such a hopeful way in that way, because we can see, well, this is how, you know, the book started, and what a delight, what a loving place this was for her. And we can, and it leaves us with hope, because, you know, Jane's approaching this new house with the exact same attitude the exact same perspective. And so we just know Jane's going to be fine.
That's right.
Yeah. She's kind of like Anne of Green Gables.
Yes.
You know, who can just turn.
She sees the world differently.
She does see
way.
It differently. And it's always, you know, it always has a positive take.
That's right.
And you hope that Jane goes through her life without losing that positivity. But she's been through a lot. She's lost her father. They don't, you know, she knows her mother is struggling, and she still is very positive. And there's a lot to be said for that.
When you read this book, you don't necessarily, until you read it two or three times, you don't necessarily see that thread of sadness that kind of hovers over this entire novel. I mean, the for sale sign is on the house,
but
the
that's perspective
time.
Too,
and that's perspective.
Because what does she say?
Yeah,
as long as that sign's there,
that's
it's
right.
Not sold.
She sees it upside down.
Right, but you know, even in their sad times, you know, they bond together. I mean, they, you know, they go through scary things. I mean, scarlet fever. They've lost their last bit of money, but they have this share and share alike attitude. And it says this in the book, that they really depend on each other to get through their difficulties. And they have a genuine trust and loyalty to each other, which, you know, as a parent is really heartening. I mean, you know, it's, you know, they're a great example of just a sibling love and loyalty that I think, you know, parents would appreciate.
Yes. And perspective again, speaking of scarlet fever. So now they have two signs outside the house. Mm-hmm. One says scarlet fever, which quarantines them. And Jane says, well, as she's very sad. She's crying over the fact that Rufus is so sick. But she says, as long as there is scarlet fever here, the house will not sell.
That's right. That's right.
So there's always a bright side. She always sees a bright side.
Well, I think Jane is a great character to introduce to students now. And one day they'll get to maybe a Chesterton novel like The Man Who Was Thursday, where the whole point of it is you have to look at God from a different angle. You have to look at reality from the other side, backwards and upside down.
Right.
And so you start with something like this, and you're prepared, maybe, you're prepared for The Man Who Was Thursday.
That's
or you're prepared for any other of some of our favorite fantasy novels, or our favorite nonsensical writers who teach us that the world shouldn't only, it ought to be analyzed. You ought to look at it bright side up.
Right.
But don't let that be it. You'll find some better, some more maybe transcendent reality if you look at it upside down.
Well, and, you know, bringing up Chesterton, you know, I think he says something that's very helpful for this book. You know, one of his quotes is, you know, an inconvenience is only an adventure rightly considered. And so just considering, you know, how we approach even our smallest inconveniences, you know, well, this can be a grand adventure. And that's what you see in the Moffats. I mean, everything that happens to them, you know, they just, they accept with, you know, great joy and excitement and a spirit of adventure. And even when it's difficult, there is sort of a humble forbearance. I mean, even their lowest, you know, experiences, they really do experience those things with, you know, a really noble forbearance.
Like when Rufus and Huey, so Rufus goes to school, he's got this terrible dilemma because Mama has told him to stay there, and Mr. Penny
Pepper.
Mr. Penny Pepper tells him he has to look after Huey, who doesn't want to be in school.
And he takes that as a charge. It becomes his duty.
And so off he goes. Yeah. So he disobeys Mama because he has to take care of Huey.
That's right.
End up on this train adventure.
Yes.
Which they thoroughly enjoy until they realize we're far from home. But I know my address.
Yeah.
And so... But they never really, I mean, they just trust that they've got a friend, Bob, or whatever his name was, that he was going to take care of them and somehow get them back home.
Well, and for Huey,
their sense of adventure is amazing for Huey.
And for Huey, that becomes his entrance into school because now he's like, so do train engineers have to go to school? And Rufus is like, well, I think they do. And
he's like, Okay, he's going to school. He's got an incentive to be
there. That's right.
He didn't have an incentive before that.
Mm-hmm. And Rufus, you know, the going to school is such an important... It's really in all of our
it
books.
And he loved it.
He loved it.
The bright, shiny book.
Right,
the pencils. He loved it.
Right.
And then he turns around and Huey's gone.
Yes.
And so, taking charge of Huey... was such an unexpected...
Well, and Rufus was five.
That's right. Well, and Rufus throughout has such a great... Some of his lines are just so wonderful because they really are maybe more than a five-year-old, and I think that's some of the beauty of Essie's writing here, but it gives a sense of his perspective on the world. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have the ridiculous scene of the two trolley men who are coming at it, you know, they're coming... And the one older trolley man that they're on his trolley... is so mad that the other guy just hasn't waited, so he takes it into his own hands. And, you know, Rufus says something like, well, they should just take it, should go at it with pistols and swords or something. I mean, it's just hilarious. He just says the funniest things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'll say things that are wise beyond his years, you know, that they're sitting there on the Salvation Army's
wagon.
And Joe is trying to tell, they get into some, what is it, they go into a ditch or something like that. And Joe's trying to give Rufus instruction, and Rufus says, well, I've seen it done. Like, he knows exactly what to do, you know, beyond this. So.
Well, even in that experience, when they lose the Salvation Army man, when he falls out of the wagon.
Yes.
I mean, it's really funny, but then they decide, okay, this is our duty to find him. We lost him. Right. Now we have to find him.
Right. Yeah. They do really have a genuine sense of duty with all of
them. They leave a note for Mama where they are.
That's right.
Notes all over town, which then get washed away by the rain.
Right.
So Sylvie thinks they've joined the army.
Right. Right. The way that they're approaching these adventures is with such entertaining seriousness.
Yes.
You know, it's not just like, well, we have nothing to do today. Like, and that's part of the fun, I think.
It is.
Well, and this relates to another essential question that we have discussed. And we've discussed it throughout some of our other books, Farmer Boy, I believe, Little House in the Big Woods. But what is the relationship between freedom and responsibility? Because I think that's what we're seeing here, is that they're very free.
Yes.
But they have a responsibility to each other.
They absolutely, and to their mother.
And part of it, I think, is the way Mother is so gracious with them because she gives them responsibility. But when, you know, things don't go perfectly, she forgives them. She accepts the results with such grace. And so she gives them the leeway to make mistakes with that responsibility that she's given them. And I think she's a great example in that way. You know, when they have a new responsibility, the way that she teaches them, you know, is... handling those mistakes and misfortunes really lovingly.
And graciously.
Right.
Yes. One good example of freedom and responsibility is when Jane has the nickel that she got for going to get the dress sleeve for her mom.
Yes.
And then she, you know, she does this whole thought in her head. She could get a piece of candy. And it would split evenly four ways because in the Moffat household, it was share and share alike. And then she buys an ice cream cone instead, which obviously she can't share. It's going to melt, so she has to eat it. And then she just, she's a pig. She's just nothing but a pig. And so she feels like she's taken her freedom and really thrown it away.
Yes.
And not used it responsibly. And then in the same chapter is when their cat has kittens, and she says, oh, and even she shares because she had four kittens, exactly what we needed. And so then she gets the favorite, she gets the one she wanted when they do the little thing to get the kittens. But then at the very end of the chapter, it says, even though she didn't deserve it.
That's right.
Because she had eaten the ice cream cone and not shared her nickel. So, you know, there are lessons like that in here. And Jane is constantly learning them. But it's all done. It's all so loving. Mm-hmm. And they just love each other. And it's so obvious, their love and affection for each other. Even Sylvie, who is, you know, older.
Yeah, she's not
is
very often. She doesn't often appear. I mean, she does, no, but it's always background.
Right. She's really become just a helper for Mother.
That's right.
And while the other three are running around having their adventures. But even she accepts their shenanigans pretty well.
You know, we've talked a lot about some of these adventures that they've had. And throughout this novel, one of our other essential questions deals with this spirit of adventure. And we've talked about the safety of their community, but we do need to temper that a little bit because some of these adventures that they have are a bit dangerous or turn on them in some way. And one of my favorite scenes where we see this is in the attic when they finally have, they get their vengeance on Peter Frost and he kind of finally gets some of his own back at him. But in this scene, they've concocted this Halloween scene and this ghost in the attic and they're so excited.
Which is their mother's dress.
Which is their mother's, that's right, that's right. And they're so excited about getting Peter Frost. But what happens is at the very end, they do in fact get Peter Frost. He didn't believe in the ghost in the attic, but now he's terrified in this scene. And yet, who is it? Jane and Janie and Rufus are both crying at the end because they're so scared. So yes, we see that
the cat gets
because the cat goes gets. Up, that's
they're
right.
all in the dark.
Yes,
so
right.
So they scare themselves.
They scare themselves, and so there is this satisfaction that we feel in this bully getting his comeuppance. But at the same time, there's risk. They ran the risk, and in fact, it did hurt them. So where else do we see some of this possible danger?
Well, Huey and Rufus on the train when they should be in school going to Boston.
Yeah.
And they just happen to run into somebody nice who, you know, the engineer. And was Bob the engineer?
I think his name was Bob.
And he, you know, he helped them get back home.
Yeah.
But there's no telling where they could have gone. Mama didn't know.
Yeah.
Mr. Penny, I don't know where Mr. Penny
Pepper.
Thank you. Where Mr. Pennypepper, what he was thinking because those boys were gone from school.
Yeah.
But that was dangerous.
Yes.
It ended up fine. And they, in their childlike way, had a great time. But they did have a moment where or at least Rufus did. I'm not sure Huey did. But Rufus had a moment where he did think, huh, how are we going to get back? Is it going to stop? Are we going to end up in Boston?
Yeah.
And then what? So it was a great adventure to them, but in the end, they were afraid. And when they lost this, when the Salvation Army man fell out of the buggy and they got lost and they realized they were going round and round the town looking for him, didn't know, you didn't want Mama to be afraid. You know, all of those things were in that moment terrifying to them. But it all ended up fine.
That's right.
So it is, it's a very happy, kind of go-lucky environment that they're in throughout the book. But I think we would want to point out to children that it, you know, that these adventures did have their downsides.
That's right. Well, I think it really comes back to perspective. I think this novel, I think that's probably the strongest of the themes that we're asking. And, you know, because in this novel, we've asked some of the same essential questions we've asked in the past, but we've really identified a few kind of new questions. And I think that perspective question is the most important, because here we have a text that for the first time is really teaching us to look at the world upside down. And what does that mean? It means looking at things that aren't often good and making them good.
And you know, something that the author does in this book, speaking of perspective, the author depends heavily on imagery in this book as well. So, for instance, she, you know, describes the mulberry trees in front of Captain Mulligan's house as standing erect like two soldiers guarding the front door. And so, you know, if we're paying attention, you know, all the way throughout, there is, you know, such a beautiful complement to the author's style and messaging in this book. So, you know, the content and the style really complement each other well. And so there are plenty of examples of just beautiful imagery that give us a heightened sense of the importance of perspective, I think, in this book.